Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome back to the Tudors Dynasty podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Larson. Today, I am joined once again by the lovely Dr. Emma Cahill-Marone to discuss Isabella I of Castile. I cannot wait to share this episode with you, and you are going to learn so much about this amazing woman.
The Tudors Dynasty podcast.
Emma, welcome back.
Hi.
I love it when you're on the show because we always talk about amazing women. And Today we are going to talk about another woman in history. It's Women's History Month. So this entire month, we're really trying to showcase powerful or empowered women in history. And today we're looking at Isabella of Castile, who many of you probably know as the mother of Catherine of Aragon. And Emma, yes. I want to start by asking you, why is Isabella so important to history?
Well, Rebecca, thank you for inviting me back and for celebrating this very important month where we celebrate women. Isabella of Castile is so important because she was a woman who changed everything in royalty. She was the queen, the first queen in that momentous time where women started to get an education with humanism and all that. In the 15th century, we see some female figures that are important, especially in the south of Europe and places like Castile. But then Isabella is the first one who takes power and actually becomes a ruling queen. And she sets the precedent for all these other amazing women that we study in the 16th century, like her granddaughter, Mary Tudor, or her successor, Elizabeth I, in the case of the Tudor dynasty, that let's not forget that half of it was ruled by women.
I love that so much.
So Isabella of Castile is Mary Tudor's grandmother.
And there's our connection to the Tudors.
Yes. And also Isabella descended from Catherine of Lancaster. So she was a Lancaster too. She had English royal blood. So she was important throughout, before the Tudors even came to power in England. There were relations and negotiations with Edward IV. So she's very connected to the Yorks and the Lancasters and very active because Castile and England had a long-standing alliance. And Isabella was never far from that. And that's why she married her own daughter, who she named after Catherine of Lancaster. She married into the Tudor dynasty. So that's why she's so connected to the history of England, too.
Can you remind listeners who Catherine of Lancaster was the daughter of?
Yes. So Catherine of Lancaster was the daughter of the first Duke of Lancaster, John of Gaunt, and his Spanish wife, who had fled Castile after her dad had been assassinated. Peter I was assassinated by his brother. This is a truly medieval slaughter history that we love. So this starts a conflict between the two branches of that house that was ruling, the Trastámara house, the one which Isabella of Castile comes from, and Catherine of Aragon too, and even Ferdinand of Aragon. So Catherine of Lancaster is born in England because her mom flees from Castile and marries the Duke of Lancaster. Her sister marries the Duke of York, and the Duke of Lancaster and Constance of Castile try to become king and queen of Castile, and they even go and try to invade Spain, and they go to Galicia. Finally, when this cannot happen, they decided to negotiate with the king, and they decided to marry their children. So Catherine, who was the daughter of Constance and John of Gaunt, becomes betrothed to the heir of that other branch of the Trastámara, and they become the first princess of Asturias, which is the title that the heirs in Spain receive. And this is mirroring the Princess of Wales. So that's another connection between England and Spain there, right there with Catherine of Lancaster. Then she goes on to be a queen consort, but her husband dies when her son is still very young, and she becomes a regent for many years. So she rules Castile. This English-born princess ends up ruling Castile for years on her own. First with her brother-in-law, who is also le left as a regent to the John II, who is Isabel of Castile's father. But then when he is elected King of Aragon by something called the Compromiso de Caspe, he goes on to Aragon, and Catherine of Lancaster rules Castile on her own. And she becomes an amazing patron of the arts. She has a woman advisor with her, which is amazing. I always thought the woman advisor who wrote the first biography written by a woman, autobiography. And then she's not also a patron of the arts and all that, but she is also someone very important in the consolidation of the relations between Portugal, England, and Castile, because her sister, Philippa of Lancaster, is queen in Portugal, and her brother is king in England. So Catherine of Lancaster is just amazing.
It's amazing how many connections there are to England.
Yes, actually, I'm doing a course now in the Instituto Cervantes about this, how from the times of Eleanor of Aquitaine and her daughter Eleanor Plantagenet, there's an alliance between England and Spain, and these women, these royal women that come back and forth from England and to Castile and vice versa, become so important in this alliance that greatly enriches both cultures, because really there's a lot of artistic exchange and new ideas that travel with these women. Very, very brave women too, because to just pack your things and leave and start over in a new place. Not that they had a choice, but they were still brave for doing it, you know, for just fulfilling those their duty, really, which is what they were taught since they were little girls.
Yes, to leave everything that you know to go somewhere that maybe that you've never
Exactly.
been, that would be terrifying. That is
Most
very
of the
brave.
times, I've never been there. Like, let's think of the example of Catherine of Aragon. And she, from her earliest childhood, she knew she was probably going to go to England. It was always, the negotiation was there. And she was treated as Princess of Wales most of her life. So she had that connection, but she didn't know. Her mother had, for example, books on the tales of Arthur and things like that. So she would have read about Camelot, and there were other books, and there were letters coming from England all the time. But you know, that's very different to going there, right? And being in England.
Yes.
It's a very different thing, for
It's
sure.
like reading books on English history versus seeing the buildings in real life.
Exactly. And meeting the people and getting accustomed to the new customs. The fact, for example, in England that, let's take an example of the language, right? For example, very close to the time where Catherine is about to leave, the Margaret Beaufort and Elizabeth of York send a letter to Isabel of Castile to, well, actually, this is the ambassador talking on behalf of the Queen and the Countess. But to get accustomed to speaking French with Margaret of Austria, who is there at the court of Isabel of Castile, because she married Catherine's brother, to get accustomed to talking in French, because in the English court, the ladies did not speak Spanish or Latin. We have to think that in Isabella's court, the majority of the women spoke Latin. So this is a difference that then when women like Catherine of Aragon arrive and become queens, they change things like this. Catherine changes this, and then we have, in just one generation, women like the daughters of Thomas More, who can not only speak Latin but also Greek, like
Right.
Mary Tudor too. So
It's
I could
fascinating.
speak about these women forever.
Well, that's why you're here today.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about Isabella and how she came to the throne. Give us that backstory on what led up to her becoming Queen of Castile.
This is a story that it should be, I mean, in Game of Thrones, because it's amazing. It's an amazing story. So she's not born to be a queen, despite the fact that she's born into royalty. She is an infanta, okay? So she's the daughter of the King of Castile, John II, but in his second marriage, okay, his marriage to Isabel of Portugal. So John of Castile had children by his first marriage, and he had his son and heir, Henry IV, who was a predecessor of Isabella of Castile, her half brother, then we realize, right? So Isabella is born into the second marriage of John II to Isabella of Portugal. And then she is born in 1451. And then a few years later, her brother, Alfonso, is also born. So she's not even second in line after her brother is born, because despite the fact that women can rule in Castile, it's not forbidden, like in the case of France, the male takes precedence over a woman, right? So she, and because she's not, she has an age difference and a different mother and a different upbringing to who becomes then the king, who is Henry IV, she doesn't grow up in court. She grows up in a place called Arevalo. She had been born in a place, she had born in Castile, in a place called Madrigal de las Altas Torres, but then she grew up in a place called Arevalo, because this was one of the places that her mother had in her dower. So in Castile, like it would be in England, mirroring Castile really, because this was Eleanor of Castile who changed this in the Queenslands. Once the king died, the widow would have lands of her own. In Castile, usually that meant cities. She was a lady of several cities. And the most notorious one was Arevalo. So they went there and they lived there. So this means that Isabel of Castile grew up speaking Portuguese, because her mother was Portuguese, in a Portuguese court in Castile. So she's already bilingual and bicultural in her upbringing. But at the same time, we don't have a lot of information about that time, because there's not a lot of because there's not a lot of documents that tell us what she was learning and the kind of things we can just guess. We can guess by what she does later on. But in the case of Isabel, we do know that eventually, when the king is going to have his heir, she's called with her mother and brother to court. Because despite the fact that she's not next in line, her brother is. So the king, Henry IV, their half brother, wants them close once he's going to have the heir. He doesn't want any problems with his two half brothers, right? Or brother and sister. And then a little girl is born called Juana. This little girl, Henry IV had had a previous marriage and had been declared that it had been declared null, and there was rumors that this little girl that he had with the queen was not his, and everybody started calling her Juana la Beltraneja, because Beltrán de la Cueva was the guy that everybody thought was the father of this new infanta. So from this point on, there's a battle between Isabella. Isabella and her brother and their faction to have Henry IV say that this girl is not his and that they are still the legitimate heirs to the throne.
Whoa.
Yes. So what the faction that is defending this decides to convince Alfonso, who would be second in line, to proclaim himself king. And they do. But Alfonso dies very suspiciously. Some say poisoned. I know this is a topic you love, so we can put Alfonso in the poison list episode, because that's what they said. So Isabella becomes the face of this faction in court, and there's a war that starts really. So Henry IV calls her to a place called Toros de Guisando, and they negotiate, and she is sworn Princess of Asturias instead of the king's daughter.
Wow.
Yes, it's crazy, isn't it? But the conditions were that she could not marry without her brother's consent. Well, Isabella didn't listen to her brother or do anything of this, and she decided on this was her main pro main the main thing that during this time of her life, and this is where she's starting to show how powerful she is. That she will not marry someone she doesn't want to. And they try to marry her to someone that she doesn't want to, and it doesn't end up well.
Did somebody get poisoned too?
Not poison, but she definitely makes a point. And so we're starting to see that you can't really mess with Isabella too much, right? And she's going to find a way to avoid doing what you don't want. She's not going to confront you directly, but she's going to resist and avoid. And it's a strategy for someone who is not in the position of power, really, if you think about it, right? So she decides to marry her cousin, Ferdinand, who we know became her husband, Ferdinand of Aragon, in secret. And Ferdinand travels, and this is why I'm saying this is like Game of Thrones. Ferdinand travels in disguise up to meet her, and they marry. And then Henry IV is not very happy with this, obviously. But eventually, Henry IV dies. And what happens in that moment is that making that Pacto de Toros de Guisando, like putting that into force, she proclaims herself queen. But the faction that is with the king's daughter of Juana also proclaims her queen. So there's a civil war that starts. Doesn't it sound a bit familiar?
Wow.
Does it? It does, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
This is where we have to think that, for example, when Mary Tudor proclaimed herself Queen of England, she knew about her grandmother and her president. She had learned about this because Catherine of Aragon had books of the story of England translated into Spanish. So I'm certain she had books of the story of Spain translated into English.
Yeah.
And Mary Tudor knew about it. I'm sure Mary Tudor was like, just like my grandmother did, I will take this throne. So there's a lot of connections between Isabella and her granddaughter too. So there's a civil war, and this is where Isabella and Fernand really become a power couple, because he's fighting the war for her, but she's there too. She is the person who is going to receive the crown if they are successful, and finally they are. And in 1474, she proclaims in Spain and Castile, the queens and kings are not crowned, they're proclaimed. So she proclaims herself Queen of Castile with the Sword of Justice. Ferdinand's not very happy about that, because that was reserved to the men. But she decided to do it when he was not there. So she was like, sorry, you were late, so I had to do it. This is the kind of things that Isabella did that I think that she was very smart to do. And she becomes the Queen of Castile. And they had been presidents of queens of the kingdom of Castile, of very powerful regions, but not of the crown, because at this point the crown of Castile is big, a powerful kingdom in Europe. So this is not just some duchess in the side corner of Europe. This is a kingdom that is becoming one of the most powerful kingdoms in Europe, that allies with another powerful kingdom in that Iberian Peninsula, and they just become a power couple. And they are the ones to be the first king and queen known as King and Queen of Spain. For example, in the as soon as they start the negotiations with the Tudors, they are called the King of Spain and the Queen of Spain. So the first idea of Spain is born in that union of Isabella and Ferdinand.
So I think you said she did not grow up at court.
Mm-mm.
So how did she learn how to navigate the politics?
I think that she was extremely smart. She was a survivor. She was extremely smart. We know that her mother had lots of mental health problems. So I think that, you know, she clearly saw what women could go through with her mother. And then she, obviously, her daughter during her lifetime goes through a lot of it. So I think in that sense, she was a person who was very contained. She was a lot of an observer in her early life. And then she could read the room very well. And when she had to take action, she did. And she was lucky. I think she was extremely lucky too. You know, at least in the first part, when she's not queen and she's navigating all of this, she's very courageous, but very lucky. And I think this is typical for people. We know which people are the great figures of history now, but at the time they didn't know it. So it was a lot of courage and a lot of luck, I think.
Yeah.
And she had both. She was a very courageous woman.
I'm learning so much about her today. I'm really
Yeah.
enjoying this. So they get married. They're now the Spanish monarchs. The most important thing that they have to do now is to provide heirs for the throne. How
Exactly.
soon after they got married did they have their first child?
So they have a child pretty quickly. They have a daughter called Isabel. She's named after her mother,
Of course.
of course. So we call her Isabella Junior. There's a really good book. It's in Spanish by Ruth Martinez Alcorlo. Dr. Martinez Alcorlo published the first biography of this very truly important princess. And she's a princess. She's not an infanta because she's the firstborn, so she receives automatically the title of Princess of Asturias. So
Oh.
that's why she's not an infanta. An infanta is the title that the daughters of the king and queen in Spain receive, but not in this case because she's the firstborn, so she's the heir, the heiress. She's born in 1470, but the king and the queen don't have another child until 8 years later.
Wow.
Yes, because you have to think that she's born during the time that Isabella is still a princess. She's not even queen yet, and they're fighting this war they don't know if they're going to survive. This is Game of Thrones, people. They don't know what's going to happen. So it's very different, the birth of Isabella and what it means, and the fact that she's a girl, which is not the ideal situation,
Yeah.
to 8 years later when the queen gives birth to a boy. Oh boy. She gives birth to a boy and they name him Juan because in the court, the Spanish court, they were very devoted to Saint John the Evangelist. And once she has a boy, and a lot of women will be able to relate to this, she has two children, she has a boy, she has three other kids in like in 4 years. I think it's a mental and we know because she's the ruling queen, we have a lot of information of her. The way that her pregnancies developed too. She had trouble with her pregnancies, but she had really good care because the leading medical doctors at the time were in Spain. There were doctors that had learned from the doctors from the north of Africa, from Jewish doctors in Spain, that there was a lot of mix of the knowledge that had been from antiquity that had been gone through all the Greek knowledge really had come through Spain via the Islam and the presence of Islam in Spain. So the doctors in Spain were very advanced and they helped her a lot. She had a doctor that helped her a lot with her pregnancies, and she eventually has five children, so one boy and four girls, which is, I mean, if, ideally you would have more than one boy, but the advantage of girls. When you are an ambitious monarch like Isabella and her husband too, who's very ambitious, the advantage of girls is that you can create international alliances now. And she has
Right.
four to do it. Yes.
And such strong alliances you can make.
Yes. The first alliance that the Spanish monarchs always look for usually is the Portuguese alliance. Because we have to think that this is another kingdom in the Iberian Peninsula, and the idea of this time is to unify the Iberian Peninsula under one monarch. Isabella and Ferdinand had already done that with the crowns of Castile and Aragon. So it was time for now to for her daughter to marry into the Portuguese crown and eventually have that monarch that would rule the whole of the Iberian Peninsula. And that could have happened because Isabella had a child in 1498. She d sadly died having this child. And it was a boy named Miguel de la Paz who, listen to this, was the heir to Manuel the First of Portugal. And the king gives a boy to her grandmother, Isabella of Castile, to raise him.
Well, that worked out nicely, didn't it? I mean,
Well,
sad that her daughter died, but in the end.
yeah, but this is how powerful Isabella was. The king of Portugal gave her own son to raise because he knew that she was the best one to raise that kid. And sadly, he dies too. Miguel de la Paz dies when he's only 2 years old, I think. He is buried with his grandmother in Granada in the Capilla Real. There's a little coffin there. Yeah. This is the sad part.
It is sad.
So we have four left. Basically, Isabella loses, and then we have to think this 1498 when Isabella dies after giving birth, but the previous year Juan dies, the boy, the heir. After he marries Margaret of Austria, they're married for some months. There had been so many rejoicings in Spain because the heir to the throne was finally married to a very important person, as was the daughter of the emperor and the Duchess of Burgundy. Because Margaret of Austria lived in Spain during that time. She was married to John. And imagine how international that Spanish court became during that time. But John dies quickly. Dies very in very similar circumstances to Arthur. You know, they're married and he dies shortly after at a very similar age. A lot, say, from using his marriage too much. Let's put it that
Right.
way.
Overexerting himself.
But you never know with these things, because that just seems like the typical thing to say, too. You know, they were saying at the time it was because of this. I think there was just a very difficult time in the teenage years for boys, and then a bit later for girls when they start having children. Because, like Isabella, right? She dies after labor.
Yeah, I
so
think it's an interesting connection you just make there. That you know, Arthur died. And Juan died, and it's almost in a sense that their wives are the ones who get blamed for it.
Of course they do, you know? Of course they do. These 16-year-old girls. Oh my goodness, just to think that. Isn't it ridiculous just the thought of that? Yes, of course. And yes, so you have to think that by 1498, there's three children left. Three girls. Juana, who was born a year after Juan, and she's in Flanders because she married Philip of Habsburg, so Margaret of Austria's brother. Maria, who was the fourth child, child of Isabella and Fernand, and Catherine, who in 1498 is a teenager, but she's already betrothed. She's the one that has another clear path. It's Mary, who goes to fill in the shoes of her sister Isabella just after she dies, and in her case, she's a bit luckier, and she is able to have 10 children with Manuel I of Portugal, but she also dies having her last child. Just some time later after having her last child in 1517.
Wow.
So by 1517, there's only the last two Trastámara women, because these are the last ones. Juana, who is imprisoned, and Catherine of Aragon, who will be imprisoned a bit later. Not very fortunate lives, right?
No, but you can see the similarities between them and their mother and how they were perceived as a threat because of how strong and intelligent they were as women. What do you do with women like that? You try to keep them away from power and you lock them up. And the same kind of thing kind of happened to Isabella too, didn't it? She was perceived as a threat.
She was perceived as a threat. She was tried to. So the reason why they tried to marry her to someone was to actually, if you married her to the guy that you wanted, then that guy could control her. By her deciding to marry Ferdinand and enter in a partnership with him, he was still her husband and he was the head of the household and all these things, but she had a lot of power too.
Yes.
So I think that was a key for Isabella, deciding to decide who she was going to marry. And then Ferdinand has his part too. We have to admit that he was a cunning monarch. He was definitely, he could be bad, he could be good. But I think all this being surrounded by women and his wife being so powerful, and it just made him realize in the end that it was useful. So he's the one not only that marries Isabella, fights for her, and gives her the power, gives her the crown. But also, when his daughter Catherine is in England, Anne decides to take on her own marriage negotiations because the Spanish ambassador is not doing his job right. He credits her as an ambassador. So this has never been done before. So he's also, we could say, a feminist in a way, because he just assumes, oh, they're doing a great job. Let's keep giving them stuff, you know? And I think the key in this is Isabella's obsession to educate her daughters, which is a very motherly thing. But I was raised in Spain. I can tell you it's a very Spanish mother thing. You have to study. You have to study. So she's the one to transform not only the lives of her daughters, but the lives of all the women in the court, because she decides that to be a better Christian, to be a better woman, you have to be educated. And education gives you a mind of your own.
She really was transforming the courts. And while she's doing that, she's doing amazing things like exploring the world.
Exactly. And then that's exactly right. So her just after she has Catherine of Aragon, so this is the Christmas of 1485, 2 weeks after, when she's still, you know, recovering from that last birth, she meets with Christopher Columbus for the first time.
Oh, and let's set a quick timeline here, because if you said Christmas of 1485, we're just after the Battle of Bosworth.
We are, and this is why, think about it. So 22nd of August is the Battle of Bosworth, if
yes.
I'm not mistaken. Oh, I got that right. and some months, the Queen's pregnant. Isabella's pregnant when Henry is winning the Battle of Bosworth. And when she gives birth in December, she decides to name her daughter after Catherine of Lancaster. Hello, Tudors. So I think it's very clear what she's doing here, right?
Yes.
Well, 2 weeks after that happens, and she has this baby. And by the way, we now know it was the 15th of December. So I don't know why everybody, in every book that I've read, it says the 16th of December. She wasn't born the 16th of December. She was born the 15th of December in Alcalá de Henares. The queen meets with Christopher Columbus for the first time. And this guy, who we all know who he is, and I don't need to explain because everybody knows who Christopher Columbus was, what is important to know is that this was not the first time he was offering this to a monarch.
Oh.
It was Isabella. Yeah, yeah. He was in England too, and he tried to gain favor in England and France. But it was Isabella who decided to finally fund him. And personally, the queen, and this is something that I want to vindicate, because they always say, Isabella and Ferdinand funded Christopher Columbus. No, it was Isabella who funded Christopher Columbus. Ferdinand had to support everything because they were in a partnership, and that's the way it worked, you know? And his name took precedent over her in documents and things like that. But it was her decision, her personal financial support to Columbus, that finally was the turning point. And also, it's very important to note that one of Christopher Columbus's greatest supports was his, we know that Christopher Columbus was Italian, was one of his fellow Italians called Alessandro Geraldini, who in 1492, the year that Christopher Columbus finally sails west, becomes the tutor of Catherine of Aragon and Mary, her sister, her older sister Mary. So this guy who is at the center of these new discoveries and all that is the person teaching her Latin history, all the things, Italian, diplomacy, everything, devotion, everything. Wow. He's her tutor. This is something that we have in Isabella's accounts. That's why we're so lucky in terms of what we know about Catherine of Aragon's education, is because we have Isabella's accounts. And he's there. He's like, he is the teacher of the infantas. And then she buys her tables, desks, books, all types of, but one of the things that I found that it was very, very cute was when in the first year of Catherine of Aragon's life, they created like a little walking cart so she could learn how to walk and things like that. Yeah, we know those things from the accounts. So that's why we're so lucky because she was a ruling queen. Like, imagine with Elizabeth the First, right? We have all that information because she was a ruling queen. With Isabella, we have the same, but we have to think this is the end of the 15th century. This is very early on. We don't have as much information for any other woman. This is the first woman that we have as much information for in the history of the world, really. So that's also why she's so important, because we see for the first time how women think when they have financial means and power and influence. Can you tell I like Isabella of Castile?
She's pretty fascinating. I'm really
She's
enjoying.
She's a badass.
Thank you for saying that.
I said it.
So I'm curious then, when Columbus discovers America, what kind of recognition did she get for it? Did anybody recognize her for it? Or was it kind of like, yeah, whatever?
Well, I mean, Columbus discovered America. That could be debatable, right?
Yeah.
It was for sure the first time that there was a connection between America and Europe, a constant connection with his trips. He makes four trips, not just the first one, right? And we have to think that he didn't think he was going to America. He thought he was going to Asia. And the name America comes from later on another fellow Italian, Amerigo Vespucci, who was like, nah, I think this is a new place. And they were like, nah, if it's a new place, we'll name it after you. And that's how America got its name. You're welcome. So, but does she get credit? The thing is, what Isabella wants Columbus to do in America is to spread the gospel, really. That is the main goal of this trip, and establish the trade, because, you know, but the main idea is, you have to think that Isabella was someone that was that could not separate politics from religion. So, and she had been enthralled to with Ferdinand in what in Spanish we call Reconquista, the reconquering of the land in the Iberian Peninsula from the rulers that from Islam, from all those Moorish kingdoms that had been. So this idea of the reconquering and Christianizing and spreading the true faith, this was the main goal in America, in the new lands discovered. And this is what she wanted. But then they are faced with the reality when he comes back that this is a different place. It's not the place we thought it was. And we found these people. And Columbus, in his first trip back, he brings people from America. And they're all very surprised because it's not the kind of people they thought they were going to find. They arrive to Barcelona in 1593. And the queen is very concerned because she's not sure if these people have heard the gospel before. And if they haven't, they are pure. You cannot, for example, enslave them. So what happens next is a big debate amongst all the scholars in Spain to see if these people in America could be enslaved and what status they had. And what was decided finally was that they were subjects of the crown, so they could not be enslaved. But because they had not heard the gospel, they were considered minors. So they were placed in the care of the people that were going to spread the gospel. So the church is basically where they take over there first.
Wow.
That's the main thing that Isabella wants in America, is to spread the Christian faith.
Which makes sense, right? It just always seems like...
Think about it from the time, right? That perspective. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the Moors, because I feel like that's a part of the history that I don't know a whole lot about, but I think it's important for the listeners to understand. We understand that she wanted to spread Christianity. But tell us more about how she went about maybe doing that and what the outcome was.
Just a quick background on why I was saying the Moorish kingdoms in Spain is because in 711, there was an invasion in the Iberian Peninsula. So it was the end of the rule of the Visigoths. So we're going very far back. And there was the establishment of what was called Al-Andalus, and a development of Moorish, first well, a spread of Islam in and the rulers that came with that in the Iberian Peninsula. And then what happened is in the north, there started to be these kingdoms that were trying to regain the territory from these rulers. So it became part of the way the rulers in the northern territories would defend their leadership was by, I am going to conquer lands from Islam so we can spread Christianity again in the Iberian Peninsula. And that became an obsession, an idea that all the Christian rulers had in the north of the Iberian Peninsula. And they went on conquering. And by the time Isabella comes to the throne, it's only the kingdom of, and this had been happening in Aragon too, and in Portugal. It was not only Castile. The invasion of the Iberian Peninsula was throughout the Iberian Peninsula. But by the time Isabella came to the throne, it was only Granada, the kingdom of Granada, that was left. But it was still there. And the kingdom of Granada was one of the most important ones. And we have to think about the Palace of the Alhambra, that if you have never been there, you have to put it on your bucket list. This is something that everybody has to see because it's out of this world. I get emotional when I'm in front of this building. It's just so beautiful. So it was a very iconic place too, right? It was the last bastion. When Ferdinand and her take on this idea of conquering Granada, they make it an international affair. And someone and people, Christian knights, and this has to do a lot. It's all related to chivalry and the Crusades and all that. Think about it too, right?
Mm.
Someone like some people, knights from all over Europe came to help Ferdinand. And you know, for example, someone who came from England was Sir Henry Guildford, who fought in the War of Granada and then was knighted in Burgos by Ferdinand. But think about this. Sir Henry Guildford also went to Holy Land. So these are connected. It is the idea of Christianity versus Islam. And in the case of the Iberian Peninsula, it was considered that they were in European territory. So when Granada was conquered in the same year Columbus sailed, 1492, it was celebrated throughout Europe. Henry VIII started singing when they told him, praising God. So this was a big deal. And this was also because of the Columbus affair and the conquest of Granada, Isabella and Ferdinand become just very, very popular throughout Europe. And the Pope, who is a Spaniard from Valencia, Borgia, he gives them a title of Catholic monarchs. So they just become in the second part of the 1490s, they're just the most famous monarchs in Europe. And this is what that relationship to Islam and what Isabella represents against the presence of Islam in Europe in the late 15th century. She is considered the one to have finished with that presence of Islam in the Iberian Peninsula. But the thing is, you can't just erase what's the people that have been there. There was a lot of the what they asked to the people who stayed was you have to convert to Christianity. And that was compulsory. It was not an option. That same year, they decide that Spain is going to be unified religiously. And they also they expel the Jews. They also say that in Spain, it can only be the Catholic faith, can only be the only one. Whoever wants to stay has to convert, has to be a Catholic. Who doesn't want to can leave their things and not pack their bags, just leave their things and go.
Oh, so they didn't make them swear an oath, and if they didn't swear the oath, they were executed?
No, they made them become baptized. And if they didn't, we all know about the Inquisition and what that entailed. So, but they did give them the opportunity. Go opportunity. They told him, become a Catholic or leave, or you will be judged and you will be burned at the stake. Usually, yes.
Yeah.
After that, there's only one religion in Spain allowed in her reign. And if you are found not to be following the true religion, you got into trouble with the Inquisition and you you would die. Yeah, you would be thrown in prison and die, or burned at the stake and die. Yeah.
This might seem like a weird question, but now I'm just curious, what is the national religion of Spain now?
Oh, that's such a good question.
I didn't mean to put you on the
No, it's culturally it's a Catholic country, and that's the main religion. The when you get the percentages, it is the majority of people are Catholic, but we do have a great presence of Islam. There's over 1 million Muslim people in Spain too, because we have to think Spain is located right next to Africa. So I mean, there's no surprise. But there's also Spain has gone through a big process of confessionalism and anti-confessionalism. So there's a lot of younger people who are not following the Catholic religion nowadays. So
Interesting.
it's a big mixed.
Yeah, I just had to know. Is it like the like England?
Culturally, it's still a Catholic country, yes.
Okay.
Historically, yes.
Okay. So, can you maybe, because we're starting to wind down here, but could you maybe talk about the final years for Isabella? What did her final years actually look like?
Well, like I said, first of all, they were very sad because her children die, right? And I was going to say anyone who's a mother, anyone can understand that a mother that loses children just is not doing well. Also, her eldest, well, who becomes her eldest daughter, has lots of mental health problems and is struggling a lot in her marriage. So that becomes a concern because she is going to be the next queen. So I think there's a despite I think despite the fact that she is the most famous monarch in Europe, that she has all these credentials to speak about for her, that she's transformed everything for women. She even brings, I'm thinking now of Beatriz Galindo, who is a woman who knows Latin, called La Latina. She knows Latin so well that that's her nickname. After all this flourishing and all this support of transforming everything, her final years are sad. She loses children. Her eldest daughter is not doing well. And then she's separated from her last two children, obviously, for she knows is the right thing to do. They have to go and fulfill their destiny, but that doesn't make it less sad. And she's very concerned about the succession too, because if her daughter is not stable mentally and she's lost her son and her grandson, what's going to happen? So she relies a lot on Ferdinand, obviously. But Ferdinand is king of Aragon. The second Isabella dies, he stops being the king of Castile. He was the king of Castile with all rights, except for the right to own what we say in Spanish, reina propietaria, or rey propietario, is the person owns the crown, and he didn't. So she knows, I think her last years are sad. And the saddest thing about it is the last, for example, the last letter, and she's very sick for the last 2 years, especially the last one. I mean, she's getting to be an older woman, obviously, at the time. The last letter that her daughter Catherine sends her from England, from London, is to ask her, how are you? I haven't heard about you in a year, and I'm very, very concerned about you. It was dated the same day Isabella dies.
Oh my gosh.
She must have had a premonition or something. And we have that letter. It's in the Archivo General de Simancas, and you can read it and you can see the date on it. The 20th of November, 24th. Let me check that right now because
That's
I don't want
quite
to get it right. The
amazing.
26th of November, she dies. That's the same date that that letter from Catherine Aragon is dated to her mother. She dies in Medina del Campo. That is the place where the marriage negotiation, the treaty, the first marriage treaty between Arthur Tudor and Catherine of Aragon had been signed in 1489. So it's very sad. It's very sad. There's a very famous painting of her dictating her testament, her will, in the Museo Nacional del Prado in Madrid. It's from the 19th century, but like these historic paintings, like we have for the Tudors too, Oh, it's powerful. It's a powerful image. You should go into their website and check it out, and maybe we could put it in the notes. And it's her dictating her last will, and you can just see everyone truly concerned because, when such an icon dies, there's going to be some trouble. And there was, really, there was. Despite the fact that Fernand was there, it was difficult after she died. And then shortly after she dies, she just becomes more and more and more famous as time goes by because she's part of that glorious time of Columbus and the Reconquista and the last Moorish kingdom, and all that becomes bigger and bigger. So she becomes a mythical figure too, not just a real, but there's so many things that they say. It's almost she had superpowers,
So, how is she seen now, or how is she taught in Spanish schools?
Oh, Rebecca, you got me with the Spanish questions today. You want to go into the difficult stuff. It's controversial. It's controversial because of this religious thing, and because she's a Catholic icon, but not just a Catholic icon, but an icon of a time where because of the Inquisition, she's and because of Columbus and the colonization of America, obviously. She's a controversial figure. Also because she w has been used by not only her successors in the 16th century, but other rulers in Spain throughout time. So she's a controversial figure, I would say, but she still remains our most famous monarch, probably. Yes. I would say that Isabel of Castile is the most famous Spanish monarch of all. Actually, there's a TV show now going on in Spain to find out who's the most famous Spanish person, and she's in the final already. No wonder she's gonna win.
Wow, that's amazing. That's
Yeah,
great.
el mejor de
Well,
la historia, which should be la mejor de la historia because it's a woman.
before we started recording, we did talk about something that I want to bring up now, how we shouldn't judge history by modern standards. And I think it's so easy for us to look at her and judge her in negative ways, but we can't. That's unfair to her. And unfair to history, right?
Right, exactly right. So, for example, just a couple examples of the things we said. In the case of the colonization, that came after her reign. At the time that she was Queen of Castile, Columbus did four trips. It was explanation trips, really. And then I wanted to mention the fact that she was really concerned about the people that were there, and she wanted them to be treated fairly. That doesn't say that she wasn't bad in other terms, because they did enslave people from Islam, and they did enslave people from other religions, and they did burn them at the stake. So I think what is important to realize is that we have to judge them by the standards of their time and not our time. And also we have to understand what was going on at the time. So, for example, the rulers in the north of Africa also enslaved Christians. It was a time when slavery was present, and this, all of them did it. Was it good? No.
Yeah.
But was it something that they were all doing? Yes. Can we judge by the standards of our time that? No, of course not. And in the case of a ruling woman, we have to understand that in many cases, she has to be, and I think this is something that we can compare Isabel to is Elizabeth I. She has to be especially assertive, otherwise she won't be respected.
Yes.
She treats very poorly Juana la Beltraneja, Isabel of Castile. But is Elizabeth I treats very poorly her cousin Queen Mary, Queen of Scots, doesn't she? So does finally Mary Tudor to Lady Jane Grey,
True.
right? So yes, was it great to send your cousin to be beheaded? No. Was it what maybe was needed for you to survive as queen and assert your power when everybody when there were people writing about how women shouldn't be ruling and some people were against your rule? Those are the questions that we need to ask ourselves. How brave were these women to take these very difficult decisions and survive and rule and have everyone respect them? I can't even imagine. You can't even have people respect you in the 21st century as a woman. Can't even imagine in the 16th century, right?
Exactly.
So that's the takeaway I want people to think about Isabella. When they hear about it, they will. Oh, she was bad. Oh, she was amazing. She was both. But at the end, what she did made a difference. And I think the most important thing that she did was she understood education gave you power, especially if you're a woman, because you're not in the same position as a man. So maybe because I would have been told this since I was a little girl, but if you're educated as a woman, you have a tool that can protect you. And I think Isabella knew this. And I think the best example of this was her daughter, Catherine of Aragon, becoming an ambassadress, something that other women couldn't have done because they didn't know Latin, you know, defending herself when she's attacked later on. No, and also having the capacity to not just go crazy when this happens, to have, and this is why Catherine of Aragon was very similar to her mother, Isabella, to restrain yourself, to have to be able to control your emotions and say, I'm going to have a strategy to try and win this instead of just giving in, right? I think that that was the most important thing that Isabella did, was to educate herself, her children, and the ladies at court to change everything for women in the 16th century and beyond. So no big deal.
Emma, what a perfect bow to tie at the end of this conversation during Women's History Month. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on the show today and teaching us about Isabella of Castile. I've really enjoyed this conversation. And if anybody wants to learn a little bit more about her, what direction would you send them?
There's a lot of books written about her. Obviously, she's a very famous. If you are looking for a biography in English, Giles Tremlett has a pretty good one. It's pretty long, so you'll be entertained. I would say that's the most accessible and easy to read. And if you are adventurous and you want to read in Spanish, there's also lots of books. We published a book on her and her daughters in Arte, Poder y Género. And also, just if you are going to travel soon, how funny it is that she's so famous and iconic that you can visit her both in the Museo del Prado in Madrid and also now in the Holbein exhibition in the Queen's Gallery in Buckingham Palace, because there are two portraits of her in these and these museums, copies of the same portrait. So this is how iconic she really was, that you can go now to two main capitals in Europe and visit her and say hi to her. And in the case, if you go to the Prado, she's next to her granddaughter, Mary Tudor. So you can say hi to Mary too. And they have this is very important because we are in Women's History Month. They are going to start the new itinerary for El Prado en Femenino, the female perspective, which is an initiative by the Prado Museum to showcase the importance of the women in the Spanish monarchy in the creation of the collections of the Prado Museum and the museum itself that was founded by a woman. So, I mean, I encourage you to go to El Museo del Prado to visit the female perspective, to visit Isabel of Castile. And very soon I will be able to share more information about that portrait because it was in possession of a very famous English king that I found recently in my research. So I can't wait to share all that with you.
Exciting. Well, I'm going to.
He was not a Tudor king. That portrait went from a Tudor king to some other king that had it.
Ooh,
so very soon.
Intriguing.
Very soon.
All right.
Yes.
Well, to wrap
You'll
up.
You'll have to invite me back, Rebecca, and I'll
of
tell
course,
you about it.
Of course. I'm going to test you right now and test your restraint, and this is going to be really hard for you.
Oh, I've got no restraints whatsoever. You shouldn't test my restraint.
I'm going to do this. Okay, Emma, if you could describe Isabella in one word, just one, that's the restraint part for you. How would you describe her?
Iconic.
Amazing. That is amazing. That That's great. Okay, that's where we end it today, because you covered a lot on Isabella of Castile today, and she truly was iconic. Emma, thank you so much for joining me.
And thank you, Rebecca, and congratulations in this Women's History Month for your wonderful podcast. You're truly amazing, and keep up the good work.
Oh, thank you. All right, everyone, until next time.
The Tudors Dynasty Podcast.